Our final case this morning is Kinsale Insurance Company versus Pride of St. Lucie Lodge, number 22-12675. Mr. Rosenthal, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Stephen Rosenthal on behalf of Pride of St. Lucie Lodge. And with me, Jim Blecky, counsel for the estate of Tanya Oliver, and Mr. Blecky has graciously ceded me his time. This case raises some interesting questions about Florida bad faith law, but I think that this court can reverse the summary judgment below in favor of the insurer, Kinsale, without breaking any new ground by simply applying garden variety summary judgment principles and established Florida law on bad faith that requires the totality of the circumstances to be considered.
Mr. Rosenthal, I'm glad that both of you are here today. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
I'm interested. I know that you're saying that we can decide this case by just looking at existing law, state law, but I'm not so sure about that, and so I want to have a discussion about that. Obviously, Powell imposes a duty in cases of clear liability. So the question I have and the problem I'm having is there doesn't seem to be any state law that talks about what do we mean when we talk about clear liability. So let's assume that we agreed with you and this went back to the district court and it went in front of a jury. What would a jury hear about clear liability?
In a jury charge?
Mm-hmm.
Florida law?
Right, because it doesn't seem to be any instructions on what is the definition of clear liability.
I think you're exactly right that the Florida courts have not articulated what that two words means, clear liability, or where liability is clear. However, one can derive from a case that the Powell court cited, the Rova Farms case from the Supreme Court of New Jersey, what it means.
I understand that, but I guess my question is, obviously that's not... They cited to New Jersey law, which is not Florida law. But here, we have to sort of look at what would the Florida Supreme Court rule on the issue. And so you're asking us to look at New Jersey law, which is not Florida law.
Well,
right?
Let me just quibble with that a bit. I mean, when the DCA in Powell cited the New Jersey Supreme Court's opinion, it did so with a parenthetical, and I think it imports that law, at least for the part
I understand that, but
into
like
Florida law.
In Powell, I mean, obviously the Powell decision, one of the issues with it is it doesn't give me enough facts. But the assumption is that in that case, she's driving a car and she hits two pedestrians. So the liability, I mean, to the degree that you can say clear liability, that seems pretty clear unless there were some... affirmative defenses, and we don't know enough about the case, but I'm assuming that there was that the pedestrians didn't run in front of the car or that there was something that would be a defense. And that's sort of the issue here, which is there were affirmative defenses in this case, and do the affirmative defenses, do they come into play, and does that preclude sort of a finding of clear liability, or is that something that would the jury would look at?
So to answer your question directly, I think the latter. The jury would have to look at it, but and one would wish there were greater clarity within Florida law defining this term, but I do think that you have two guideposts. Both the Powell cases, you know, quotation of Rova Farms, and Rova Farms has this potential liability of the insured is obvious standard. So potential, obviously potentially liable standard, which is a little easier to understand, and it's more malleable than clear, which you say, for example, would be an insurance company admits, or it's a case where the facts are so clear, there's no...
Or you run a red light and you hit another car, clear liability.
Correct. Those are the easy cases.
Correct.
And they don't define what the floor is for clear. But and the second...
So the question is, should we certify this question to the Florida Supreme Court? Because this is not going to go away. Even with the statutory change, the Powell issue is still going to be out there.
So here's the other data point I would give you that I think might answer that question, at least to my satisfaction it does, which is this court's published decision in American Builders, which applies Powell, Florida law, sitting in diversity, like this case, and says even where the insurer believed it had a strong liability defense This is the guy who falls off a roof and gets injured and then admits, apparently, that he stepped off the roof and effed up, is what the quote is in the opinion. Gives rise to a strong liability defense. Even in that circumstance, this court, just in this year, and I believe Judge Marcus may have written that opinion, found that the Powell Doctrine applies, that the duty, the initial affirmative duty, is triggered.
But there was no discussion in American Builders about clear liability and what does that mean. And the true issue here, I mean, the only issue in this case really is, does Powell apply? And if Powell applies, it has to be only based on clear liability. That sort of is really the crux of the question. What does clear liability mean in this case? Because in American Builders, obviously there you're talking about an employer-employee situation. Here you're talking about an invitee onto the premises who has now been asked to leave, so they have a trespass defense. There's a lot of other affirmative defenses that they have potentially. So the question becomes, you know, is there an objective standard? Is the objective standard going to be 70%? Is it a percentage, 80%? Or is it, if you have an affirmative defenses that are viable, that there's no clear liability? I don't know the answer to that, and that's why I'm suggesting that perhaps my former colleagues in Tallahassee would be better suited to answer this.
I have four things that I want to respond to that. First, I'll just say I don't think a certification to the Florida Supreme Court is necessary or really even appropriate under these circumstances, particularly because of the facts of this case. Let me just say that in the American Builders case, this court had to cross that legal question in its mind to reach the decision to apply Powell, despite the existence of a quote-unquote strong liability defense. So that's been reached, and so it would tend to disprove the notion that clear can only be running a red light or mowing down a pedestrian in broad daylight. The other thing is that, and this is why I started with saying garden variety summary judgment law, let's put to side for a moment this question of the unexplored clarity of liability standard. And I don't think a numerical standard, by the way, is just workable. It's just impracticable. On the facts of this record, Judge Moore had before him evidence from both sides about whether the liability was clear. He did not credit, and he at least didn't discuss, so perhaps he ignored, it's the inference we get from the short opinion, we were defendants in a declaratory judgment action, but the claimant side of the story. There were witnesses who testified in competent fashion. The original lawyer who retained the case, Joseph Landy, that it was a grave error by security not to wait longer, and his view in deposition was clear liability.
I understand all of that, Mr. Rosenthal, and I may agree with you that Judge Moore may have given short shrift to the evidence presented by your client. But the question I have is that if it goes back, the jury does not have a clear definition of what the term clear liability means. And they are going to have to get that definition in this case.
So I hear you, Judge Lagoa, and I think your point is valid. Juries in Florida and federal court have been utilizing this clear liability standard since Powell was, you know, adopted in 1991, I think. And the issue has not presented this kind of narrow dispute requiring the type of clarification to certify to the Florida Supreme Court. I think that the Rova Farms case, which is cited in Powell, as I've said, I won't repeat it, gives a more workable standard, which is part of Florida law. And I think that the jury can be charged in this case, assuming we win and it's remanded for trial.
Can I turn you to the Rule 56 application? So as I read the record, the Pride of St. Lucie Lodge presented a number of pieces of evidence indicating that this was a case of clear liability. And it looks to me like the district court didn't credit that testimony or read it in the light most favorable to the lodge in applying Rule 56. Having said that, the one piece of evidence I think that cuts against you in the record, maybe not for summary judgment purposes, but I want you to discuss it, is what seems to be the undisputed testimony that the assailant, once escorted out of the building, left the property completely and then came back, which would be, I presume, a sort of causation defense, that even if they had security guards who would have escorted the people off the premises, even if they had security cameras, this would not have been prevented because they came back after leaving completely.
And I would emphasize the fact that we know that they came back. There is no question that that occurred. There's no question that Kinsale became aware that the party that apparently walked away at some point did come back, the shooting party. And what's
before,
also—
Before the shooting?
That's my understanding of the granular pieces of evidence. But I think there's another fact that's critically important there. And I agree with you, Judge Jordan, that it doesn't affect summary judgment. It shouldn't. But even for trial purposes, thinking ahead potentially, perhaps wishfully, the other fact that Kinsale knew was that the security guards went inside before those people came back.
Right, but the issue becomes, and I'm just going to do a hypothetical. So you have a bar fight ensues, and let's assume that they do what some of your experts claim they should have done, which is you take one group out, you make sure they leave the property, okay? Then you take out the other group. But the other group, the first group comes back and they do a drive-by and they do a shooting. What is the liability? Is there clear liability then on for purposes of the premises?
So I would point you to what the expert Lou Jack cited, which was an industry publication, and it's docket entry 107-2. And inside this article about security involving bar fights, it says, and I quote, "Security employees should monitor the club's parking lots or those close by and routinely used by the club's patrons, starting at least 30 minutes before closing time," and here's the key point, "and continuing until all patrons and employees have left." All patrons
that,
had not left.
But the point, though, is that if you have a drive-by shooting of people who have left the premises, there, how is it possible for security to prevent that if you're doing a drive-by shooting in a car?
Because, I mean, this is the scenario. Not everybody had left. Two fighting parties. One fighting party is still in the back parking lot of the lodge, of the premises. The security is there.
No, but I'm talking about in my hypothetical, which is my hypothetical is the person has left and they come back in their car and they do a drive-by shooting. How is that possible that you could stop that, even if you're in the parking lot and you have security there?
Okay, so I'm going with your hypothetical. In that hypothetical, if the other fighting party, Party B, is still in the parking lot on the premises, and the security guard has not gone back inside, but has actually waited as per, you know, standard procedure, presumably, and in your hypothetical, somebody drives by and shoots them, you're asking me whether they can intercept the bullet and prevent it? That's a question that I can't answer. It is entirely possible that a jury could find in that circumstance that it's not.
The easier answer is that the security guard should have gotten the victim to leave too, because they were excluded. So they should have left the premises completely too.
That's correct, and that's the import of this.
And then the victim would not have been there when the assailant returned.
At least on the premises for which this entity is responsible.
I don't know what the answers are either. It just seems to me that this is the sort of stuff that juries try to figure out.
Agreed. And recognizing that I've done what I always do, which is go into my rebuttal time, I just want to flag one other issue. Judge Marcus.
Yes, I have a fact question. I read the police report with considerable interest. The officers said he spoke with Ferguson and Andrews, the security guards. Ferguson and Andrews removed Almore and an unknown female for fighting in the club. The unknown female was described. According to Ferguson and Andrews, the female started arguing in the rear parking lot of the club, and at some point, Almore was struck in the face with a shoe, causing a laceration to her face. Then the females separated. One group gets the car and drives back in. The other car is there, and the shooting occurs on the premises of the lot, if I have that right.
Right.
Do we know when one of the security guards took one group out into the parking lot, he witnessed that physical altercation on the parking lot, or he was told about it by someone else?
So I'm holding up the police report because all we know, and I'm putting we being Kinsale, whose knowledge is really the most critical thing in this bad faith case, all it knew from the police report about that was what you just described. None of the subsequent investigation, and this is the last point just to flag so I can come back to it and rebuttal if necessary, the investigation by Kinsale, they didn't receive information from Mr. Danowitz, the other insurance company, Mount Vernon's investigator, about details that would answer your question, because he did interview a couple of those security guards. And that information did not make its way into the
claim. Well, the reason I asked is because the record looks so limited here factually. There was a whole trial, et cetera, that never made it into this record, presumably by the design of able counsel. But it didn't make it into the record here. So all we have a police report that the guard, or at least one of them, may have actually been outside when the second altercation, the shoe, et cetera, actually occurred.
Precisely. And that's it complicates the scenario in the hypothetical that Judge Lagoa raised, because in this case, the security guards for the lodge, our client, had witnessed a continuation of the fight. All the more reason to stay outside. So it's a clear negligence situation, clear liability from a premises liability standpoint, from our standpoint in this case. And I think, given the time, I'd like to reserve whatever the court may indulge me.
You've got your full time for rebuttal, Mr. Rosenthal.
Thank you.
Mr. Geddes.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Morning.
Edward Geddes on behalf of Kinsale. This appeal certainly raises very interesting issues about what to do with the Powell Doctrine. There, I think Judge Lagoa is correct. There is virtually no guidance from Florida case law as to how this test is supposed to be applied. The limited guidance that I've seen, that, and it doesn't come from a Florida court, I've seen it in this court's decision in Aris, which admittedly was a release case. It wasn't, the facts weren't the same, but what the court noted in that instance, what it focused on, was that the time period that matters is the time period at which the decision whether to tender or not tender the policy limits. That's the critical time.
Well, and that's why the percentage analysis, like to say, like if the jury comes back with 70% or 50% or whatever, is sort of strange to have that analysis, because the Powell analysis really is at the moment what you're supposed to be doing to investigate and to determine whether or not, as it says, whether liability is clear. An injury so serious that a judgment in excess of the policy limits is likely. I also find it interesting that Powell also says, bad faith may be inferred from a delay in settlement negotiations, which is willful and without reasonable cause. So it looks to me like also there has to be a willful determination or finding also under Powell. But let's just set aside that for a moment. Let's just talk about the liability is clear. What is really the analysis there? Because I'm not sure it needs to be the percentage analysis either.
I think, Your Honor, that, I mean, certainly the available case law that we have, the vast majority of the available case law that we have, starts from a premise that the insurer, at some point in the investigation, concludes, yes, our insured is clearly liable. Or we're fairly convinced, and they document, they note that that threshold has been crossed. And most of this court's jurisprudence on this subject tends to start at that premise. Even Harvey, the Florida Supreme Court's decision, also starts at that premise.
But Harvey also was a clear liability. I mean, that was,
right, exactly.
No question that they were at fault.
Right. And so the question becomes, how did Powell, which is a wholly judicially contrived doctrine, right?
But almost all of Florida bad faith law is.
I understand, Your Honor,
that goes for tort law in most states.
Right, and I think Powell arose as an exception to the rule. In other words, where you have a situation where there is no communication.
Because this Powell is a no demand case.
Right. There was no demand, but there was a request for information. There wasn't a demand for settlement, but there was this constant colloquy back and forth between the plaintiff's counsel and the insurance counsel that said, hey, we have mounting medical expenses, we need information, you're not providing the information. And then when the insurer turns around and says, well, we were never asked for a settlement, no demand was made, Powell comes along, the court in Powell comes along and says, well, not so fast, because you can't just bury your head in the sand when there is back and forth saying, here's the injury, it's severe, we need information, and you don't do anything. And so Powell can't consume or can't eat the entire body of case law.
I get that, and right. I get the very limited amount of help we have from the Florida courts on what quote-unquote clear liability means. Here's my problem with the district court's order in this case. Everybody agrees that under Florida law, whatever the ultimate standard is, it's objective, right? It's objective, right?
Right. Some court comes along and makes a determination that whether or not liability was clear at that point in time.
Right, but it's not subjective. It's not what the insurer thought, right?
No.
It's what a reasonable insurer in that position should have done.
No, that exercise, that determination made by the insurer at that critical moment in time has to be subject to some kind of criteria, some kind of standard. Otherwise...
But it's subjective.
Right. I mean,
it's an objective standard.
Correct.
Okay. So it's
based upon what's known at the time, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Agreed.
Right.
Agreed. The lodge put in evidence from its expert, from the adjuster for Mount Vernon, and from the lawyers, the underlying lawyers, maybe more, but at least there's that, saying that this was a case of clear liability. Now, I might feel different about this case. I speak only for myself. If the district court had discussed that evidence and why it didn't matter, but there is no discussion of any of that evidence in the district court summary judgment order. And it seems to me that's a big problem, because you have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. Bad faith is usually, although not always, an issue of fact under Florida law. And you've got a number of pieces of evidence saying this was a case of clear liability. How do you get summary judgment out of this record?
I'd like to pull apart all
sure.
the various different components. Regarding counsel's opinion about clear liability, I am seriously struggling with the notion that summary judgment can be avoided simply because the lawyers who got the case in the first place, once they file a bad faith claim, get to come forward and say, oh, and it was clear to us.
Why is that a problem?
Because it doesn't establish anything about what Kinsale knew at the time.
No, they're basing their perspective on having litigated the case.
Exactly.
And having reviewed the file of what Kinsale knew at the time.
I mean, I want to be careful there, because yes, they litigated the case. Everything that happened post commencement of the lawsuit, all the details, everything that got built up post lawsuit wasn't known to Kinsale at the time. Kinsale investigated, and this is when we look at this concept of the totality of the circumstances, I say, what was the totality of the circumstances at the time that Kinsale was put on notice?
And that's why the Powell clear liability is at the moment that the insurer is doing its in essence its due diligence. Okay.
Correct. Yes,
because
I agree.
When you're doing the due diligence, you have to determine There has to be a determination that there's clear liability, and that's why this is the determination of what clear liability is so important, because if an affirmative defense, a viable affirmative defense, is available, does that preclude a finding of clear liability? And so that's why, and there isn't a case on that. So we would be making that determination in the first instance, and I'm not sure that we're the appropriate body for that because it's not our law.
Your Honor, I find it hard to find fault with anything that you just explained. I mean, there were a series of defenses, right? And with the court's indulgence, I mean, first of all, there was—
Let me ask you as a prefatory matter. Do you think we should be certifying this question to the Florida Supreme Court and asking them to tell us what clear means?
Well, I suspect that the certified question wouldn't just be tell us what clear means. I think it would be a little bit more elaborated.
I understand, but I'm going to the heart of the reason that we might certify.
Well,
it's not clear what it means to say clear liability.
Well,
is that a question we should be certifying? You didn't ask for it in your briefing.
Correct.
Mr. Rosenthal didn't either. Is it your view we should be sending this case to the Florida Supreme Court?
I think this court can decide the case without certifying a question to the Florida Supreme Court based upon the Welford case. And in Welford, the district court, not this court, but this court affirmed the district court's decision below. In Welford, the district court struggled with this question, this very question of what does it mean? What is clear liability? And it relied on dictionary definitions for absence of any other guidance. And it concluded that clear is unambiguous, you know, without doubt. That's how the district court in Welford reached its conclusion that Powell threshold had not been crossed.
Wouldn't that generally be an accepted understanding of the meaning of clear when appended to liability? The adverb would mean plain or obvious.
Yes, without doubt, unambiguous.
But there's not much dispute about that. On the other hand, you might put a number on it, but you're not suggesting that clear liability should be given a comparable statistical number, are you?
It's almost impossible to know where to draw the line, Your Honor. So
is it the same as in the law we look at proof by a preponderance? That's just barely more likely than not. We look at the far end of the spectrum, beyond and to the exclusion of every reasonable doubt. And then we have something sort of floating in the middle. We call it clear and convincing. Is that what we're talking about here?
I wish I had the crystal ball to answer your question, Judge Marcus, because it strikes me that if if you start from a premise, the premise that I'm asking the court to accept, that Powell articulated a doctrine that was meant to be an exception to the rule, it should not be read overly broadly, because otherwise it could, as Judge Jordan, you acknowledged, it could swallow the whole. So if you look at the language they chose, clear liability, in the context in which it rose, which was a willful decision not to engage in settlement discussions, you know, clear has to mean something more than, as my friend on the other side has suggested, potential liability.
Oh, it's got to be plain and obvious. Let's start from that for a moment.
Correct. And so
let me ask you a question this way. Taken in a light most favorable to the non-moving party, which is unambiguously the standard we have to apply, why could not a jury find, if it were to credit these pieces of evidence in this record, that liability was clear and obvious? One, the altercations, and by my reading there are three, all occur on the lodge's premises. The first fight, two women get into a brawl on the dance floor. They're separated out by the guards. One is taken out the side door, which goes into the parking lot. The second is taken out to the sidewalk, which leads to the parking lot. The second brawl occurs not just between two women, but the whole group. Three and three get into a fight in the parking lot. Somebody takes a shoe and smashes the shoe in the face of someone else and slashes them in the face. It may be that that was witnessed by one of the guards. If you read the police report, you can't really tell from this record. And at some point, the brawl stops. Three of the six go off to get their car, which is off the site. And the other people get in the car, and they're starting to drive out, but they cannot get out of the parking lot owned by the lodge because the other car comes back in and starts blowing them away. Two shooters in the front seat of the car shoot at the people in the other car. We know that the entire incident occurs within 10 to 15 minutes of having been basically taken out of the parking lot. We know that Andrews, one of the guards, was familiar with one of the shooters, and he says that he knew that one of the shooters had bragged to him earlier that, quote, she was liable to shoot. Why, under these circumstances, couldn't a jury, if they credited all of this, conclude that there was clear liability? The rest of the equation is easy. That is to say, whether the injuries are so serious that a judgment in excess of the policy limits is likely, an insurer has an affirmative duty. We know this is a grievous injury. We know right from the report of the policeman that very day that one of the women is shot in the head, she's in critical condition, and she dies like a year later or something like that. But if you credit all of this stuff, and they don't have to, but if they did, couldn't a juror find clear liability?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, for the following reason. Because I believe the question that the jury has to answer in order to effectively apply Powell is to ask, what did Kinsale know back in 2015 before the lawsuit was filed? It can't ask the question.
I agree with that.
The benefit of
I agree with all of that, but every fact that I asserted was known in advance, wasn't it? One, that there were three fights, one inside, a brawl outside, and then a shooting outside in the parking lot. No dispute about that. There's record evidence to that that your client would have been aware of on the front end. Two, that the guards took him out through two doors. Three, that the guard had said in advance that he knew that one of the shooters had bragged to him earlier that there was a that she was liable to shoot, for that the whole thing took only 10 or 15 minutes. Weren't all of those facts known sufficiently in advance?
But assuming all those facts were known, right, the returning of the shooters, the targeted assault upon Miss Oliver, is not a negligent security scenario. This was a negligent security claim, the garden variety of which is you failed to do something that would have prevented this harm from occurring. If this were a case about your negligent security resulted in the harm, the laceration from the thrown shoe, maybe the situation would be slightly different. But the harm here is the shooting. the shooting that occurred after the shooters left and came back. Why? Because they were targeting a particular individual. And if that's the case, if that's the dynamic that led to the harm, that caused the harm, it does not arise from the failure of security cameras. It doesn't arise from whether or not the security guards were volunteers. It doesn't arise from whether or not there was an altercation in the club. All of that is...
Help me with Florida law. Did the guards have an obligation to get both groups off of the property safely? Did they have an obligation, for example, to stop the fight in the parking lot?
Well, stop. There's no indicate. I don't know the answer to the question of whether they had an obligation to stop the fight in the parking lot. But even if that obligation had existed, it does not change that that's not the harm that's...
Oh, I understand that, and that's where I'm asking the question. Did they have an obligation to get both groups safely out of their area?
I don't think it's the obligation to make sure that they were out of the area.
Right, I'm asking about whether they had a duty of reasonable care that required them to get the two warring groups out of their property, off the parking lot, out of the interior. Was that their obligation under these circumstances when all of this happened within a very, very short period of time?
I don't know how to answer the question, Your Honor. Honestly, I can't tell you for sure. It strikes me that the security guards, under available law, did what they were supposed to do, which was, oh my goodness, I apologize.
No, you're answering my question. Don't worry about the red light.
I apologize. I glanced.
No. Go.
It was 5 minutes.
Finish answering, right. Judge Marcus, and then we'll turn to whatever's left.
They took them outside. Outside opposite. And again, I'm trying to put this in the context of what Kinsale was reacting to when it received the limited information it got 8 months after the incident happened. The security guards break up the fight. They take one group out the back door, one out the front door, right? The ones they take out the front door run around to the back and keep fighting, keep arguing, right? It appears that one of the security guards noticed that there had been another altercation, and they waited until the parties went to their vehicles, because that's in the police report. So did they comply? Yes. Is there some greater heightened obligation under Florida law, not under the opinion of somebody hired to opine, but under Florida law? I'm not aware of case law that specifically says that the duty of care is that you must absolutely ensure that those patrons leave the property.
Mr. Geddes, aren't experts routinely used in bad faith cases under Florida law?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
Then tell me how the district court could properly enter its summary judgment order with at least tackling the expert's report in this case. It's one thing if you say, here's what the expert said, the report hasn't been excluded, I have to consider it at summary judgment, here's why I don't think it creates an issue of fact. Okay. But there's nothing.
Okay.
That gives me a lot of pause in reviewing a summary judgment order.
I understand, Your Honor. And I say this with all due respect to Judge Moore, the quality of his decision in terms of what he laid out is not ultimately what leads us to the correct response on appeal.
I agree with that generally, and we're applying the same standard, so we can do it correctly ourselves if we think there was a mistake.
Correct, and you may
tell
affirm,
me why the experts,
may affirm on any ground that...
Tell me why the expert's report in this case and his conclusion, his opinion, does not create an issue of fact viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the lodge.
Because what was clear is measured by what Kinsale knew back in 2015.
Doesn't he use that barometer as his standard for giving his opinion?
I don't believe so. He is not factoring in, for example, the targeted nature of the attack. Let's just take that one component, right? That one single component.
That just means you think his opinion is wrong.
No, I understand. But if Kinzale in 2015 thought we have a viable defense here because the shooters came back and targeted Miss Oliver, that's not clear liability. Now, you may lose if you go to trial. You may argue the case on that theory and not prevail. But the question is back in 2015 when with the available pool of knowledge it had, it made a decision about whether liability was clear. And to Judge Marcus's earlier point, there is no dispute about the injury component of the test, okay? If back in 2015, Kinzale pauses and says, wait a minute, how does this fall within the notion, the traditional Florida case law of negligent security when the shooters come back and do a drive-by shooting and target? That doesn't fall within it. That's a possible defense. What about the idea that Miss Oliver, when she was ejected from the club, was no longer an invitee? She lost her status as an invitee, and therefore whatever duty of care arose isn't available. Maybe that's another defense. It may not prevail, but it's something we have to consider. Is there a policy exclusion here because alcohol was involved? We have an exclusion on our policy. We have no coverage if there's alcohol involved. We don't know that yet. We can't figure it out. Nobody is talking to us. If this is the thought process in 2015 for Kinzale, and this court, looking back on what was known then, says, well, it's not crazy. There's at least a colorable argument to be made that these were defenses to a negligent security claim, then I don't see how Powell can be met, no matter what somebody years later, after the benefit of a trial, comes in and opines.
You're a good attorney, and so is Mr. Rosenthal, and you've made a very convincing jury argument to a trier of fact. But we're at summary judgment, and you're pulling inferences just like they're pulling inferences. I just see it as a tough case for you under Rule 56, but you've answered my question, and you've done it in a very good way.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'll acknowledge this is a difficult case where there's not much guidance in terms of...
So let me come back to the question Judge Lagoa raised.
Should you certify?
Yeah. Does this case merit certification to the Florida Supreme Court to tell us in context what clear liability means?
As Your Honor noted, neither party requested it. From our perspective, we think the district court in the Ellis decision used the correct determination. Is it clear at that time, absolutely unambiguous, without doubt, that's the liability that Kinzale had to be confronted with? And that, by the way, I think dovetails with the significant body of case law from this court.
But that becomes the issue, which is at the end of the day, if the Florida Supreme Court comes back and says, if you have viable affirmative defenses, it's not clear liability, then it doesn't matter what the facts are. I mean, or if they come back and say, you know, they come back at 50%, if there's a 50% chance, it's clear liability. I don't know what they would say.
I understand.
My point is that at the end of the day, you're asking us to opine on an area of the law that is unsettled, even if I agreed that Judge Moore's reasoning was wrong.
Okay, Mr. Geddes, we've taken you way over your time.
We
don't
want to
cut
indulgence.
You off arbitrarily given how much we've asked you. So you've got 30 seconds to wrap up.
I think at this point, if we consider the reason for the Powell Doctrine, that it's an exception to the rule, and that it chose to use the language clear liability, then I would suggest, Judge Lagoa, that where the Florida Supreme Court is likely to come out on this issue is with the plain meaning, that if you have a viable affirmative defense, you can't have clear liability. But if you have a preposterous defense, one that has no foundation in the facts, then the court examining it could look back and say, no, you acted in bad faith. So with that, I appreciate the court's time. I respectfully ask that you affirm. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm trying to pick where to start. I'd like to just start with what Judge Marcus asked, if I may, because there's a lot of issues on the table. Florida law is quite clear about what an establishment's duties are, its obligations in the circumstance where this fight happens and it spills outside, or they're evicted and it's spilled, taken outside. And it's at page 34 of our initial brief, footnote 10, we cite two cases, Hall versus Billy Jacks from the Florida Supreme Court in 1984, and Borda versus East Coast Entertainment from a District Court of Appeal in 2007. The upshot of those cases is that the establishment has an obligation to protect these patrons from reasonably foreseeable harm from the fight.
Right, but is she a patron when she's expelled? Is she an invitee still?
My understanding of the Florida law on this is yes. Now, the other thing that Mr. Geddes has done by throwing that wrench into the gears here, I feel like his chocolate's in my peanut butter or something, is that...
It's a good flavor.
What's that?
It's a good flavor.
It's chocolate. A good flavor, not a good argument, though, because it wasn't raised in the briefs. And Mr. Geddes did not write these briefs, so I'm not holding him to it, but a party is held to the argument it's raised. There are several things that have not been raised that were articulated by Mr. Geddes. The not an invitee concept is brand new. It's not a really appropriate consideration for this appeal. The alcohol exclusion in the policy of Kinsale, not raised. That was a big deal in the other insurer, Mount Vernon's thing for a gun exclusion, so there was no coverage there. That was part of the case. And also the issue of the willfulness part of the Powell decision, not raised as an argument on appeal. Even below, that willfulness piece is just not part of this case.
I think he raised it because I raised it here.
True.
But I was just commenting, and I'll give you additional time since I'm taking your time, but I only raised it because in all these discussions about Powell in different cases, I mean, there is this language that the third DCA used about bad faith being inferred based on a willfulness determination, and it seems to me that it's part of the doctrine, and it's just sort of like disregarded, but it's in there in the opinion from the third DCA.
That's right, and I think that the way that it typically plays out in the case law is that the insurer is aware of certain facts, certain data, information from which willfulness can be inferred. And in this case, and this kind of goes to what Judge Marcus was asking, so I'm kind of pivoting back to answer both if I can, that if you look at objectively, which is agreed, that's the standard, at what Kinsale Insurance Company knew as of December 3rd, 2015, and was that a case of clear liability under this existing Florida case law? The answer is very strongly yes. It
he
knew.
He suggests one interesting thing in that regard that I'd like you to comment about. He says the actual shooting, holding that third of the violent encounters apart, occurs under circumstances that are substantially different from the fight in the bar, on the dance floor, and the fight soon thereafter in the parking lot when they have, and we may even have a guard watching it. Because what happens here is three of them leave the premises completely, and they only drive back in. And it's only then that the shooting occurs. Does that circumstance at least create a sufficient question or doubt as to be sufficient to undermine the conclusion, clear liability?
No, it doesn't. Certainly not.
Why not?
Not at summary judgment, for two reasons that I can think of right now. First, I read to you what the expert read or cited from a authoritative source about negligent security practices. And that practice said, and I'm repeating myself, is that you don't leave when party A or party B is still there. Probably for exactly this reason, because they're fighting with each other. Just because someone went away, they might have gone away to get a firearm, which is what happened in this case. So you don't leave until both parties have cleared out. The second thing is that it's not clear to me that Kinsale knew what you're saying, Judge Marcus, which is that the group actually left completely. What they did know as of December 3rd, very early, 2015, was that the shooting occurred of their invitees in their premises, in the parking lot, that there was no proof that the security stayed outside until both parties left, and that a mother of three was shot in the head. Those facts by themselves give rise to a strong inference of clear liability under those two cases of Florida law that I cited, which is a body of Florida law. They didn't learn facts, and this is part of the willfulness inference that jumps off the page here. Their investigation was not adequate. If you look at the claims notes of Catherine Thrift, Kinsale's claims adjuster, senior claims examiner, there are like three or four entries with facts about what happened. Over the course of many months, they don't investigate on their own. Now, they say we offloaded that to this other insurance company for which they were not paid and from which they did not get the written reports. So the only information that's recorded about what Kinsale knew is in those bare bones claims notes. And they knew precious little that would have warded them off from the obvious conclusion, at least that our side testified to from day one,
would
their
you,
evaluations
would you,
was
would
clear
you agree,
liability.
Though, that what you look at for purposes of the Powell analysis is the insurer's knowledge at the time of, well, not at the time of the incident here, because the incident's in March, and it's not until December that they're notified, but what they knew at the time prior to suit being filed.
So knew or should have known.
Yes, no, right. Knew
reasonable diligence.
Right, whatever the due diligence is at that moment in time. That's what I'm saying, not after suit is filed. And that's why I have to go back to look at the experts, but it's what they should have known, what they knew or should have known at the time of the due diligence.
Correct. And in this case, that runs from November 20th, 2015, when they first received the claims notice, through August 5th, 2016, which is when suit was filed. So there's a, what is that, 9-month period or so, okay, during which they could have
obtained certain... I think that's the one agreement that you both have.
I agree with Mr. Geddes on a lot of things, but yeah, within this case, yes. And just to answer your question, and I'm mindful of time, if you want to see the key excerpts of Lou Jack's testimony, the expert, in our reply brief at page 12, we unpack that, and it talks about what was known at the time. All the evidence from our side of the case was tethered to the relevant time period, what we knew. Now, it may be true that some lawyer who's hired later on can only indulge in hindsight, but of course, that is competent testimony at summary judgment.
And just to understand, can I ask one more question?
Of course.
Just last question. Mr. Rosenthal.
Go ahead, please.
I gather from your argument today that it's your position that an affirmative defense, even a viable affirmative defense, does not extinguish clear liability.
Yeah. In fact, I think that this panel is bound by the prior precedent rule from American Builders, where a strong liability defense did not prevent reliance on the Powell Doctrine to conclude that this case...
Yeah, but you can't go so far as to say because it wasn't enough there, it could never be enough, or it wasn't enough here.
Yeah, I just don't know what not enough you're referring to, Your Honor.
Well, there may be an affirmative defense that's sufficient to cloudy the record to make it not clear in this case, even if that wasn't the case there. I have a final question for you. As I understand the standard, it requires two things: clear liability, and that the injuries have to be so serious. The second one everybody agrees to. Are these airtight compartments, or does Florida law recognize that you look at this thing holistically? Normally, when we look at risk, we ask two basic questions: likelihood that harm will occur, gravity of the harm that will occur. And we compound the two and come out with some answer. That's how we do foreseeability all the time. Does the gravity of the harm here, woman shot in the head in critical condition, bear in any way on the determination, or are these really airtight compartments for purposes of Florida law?
It is designed to be a totality of the circumstances analysis. They are not airtight compartments. An analysis of risk to the insured, which the insurance company has to engage in to protect and discharge its fiduciary duty to my client, the Lodge, requires it to consider all relevant factors and how that might play out. We don't live in a numerically perfect analytic system. The law is complex, as you all are very well familiar.
And perhaps it should be that way. And when I think of risk, I think of it in classic terms: likelihood of harm, gravity of harm. And as the gravity goes up, the likelihood may go down. But I'm asking you whether Florida courts have ever come at this problem in a bad faith case where they're looking at, and we add to the one because of the magnitude of the other.
So the best way I can answer that question, Judge Marcus, is with two thoughts. One, in Harvey, the Florida Supreme Court's last statement on bad faith law, it said the totality of the circumstances test applies. That was a Powell case like this. It did not say, but we're going to carve out an airtight exception for this threshold determination of what clear liability
is. But in Powell,
that's not possible.
That was the facts of that case were, I mean, to quote, clear liability. There was clear liability there. The question was, really, Harvey really dealt with, like, the investigation. It only took 9 days, but it was, that was a determination that it was so clear that they should have, like, settled on day one.
I mean, and all of these, every case is going to have different sets of facts. Some are going to be at the top of the scale where near the ceiling, it's super clear, completely clear. Others are going to be in the middle. And I think Judge Marcus's point is one that's well taken. It, a test that comports with human experience and the way that courts have to, the way that insurance companies have to evaluate risk and the way that courts have to objectively assess that evaluation of risk involves a balancing of factors. And I come back to Powell, and I'll end with this, which says, and I quote, they're quoting Rova Farms after this statement about where liability is clear, and they have a parenthetical that says where substantial injuries and potential liability of insured are obvious. Potential liability is obvious. That's a case where a man dove into a muddy lake on the defendant owned the property, and it turned out to be 4 feet deep, and he broke his neck. And the defendants in the case thought that there was a strong affirmative defense that he should have known it was so shallow, and it was stupid to dive into a muddy lake not knowing the depth. Those are the facts that the Powell court relied upon by implication. So clear liability is a multivariate analysis, and in this record, especially because, respectfully, the district court just didn't consider all the evidence, summary judgment should be reversed, and this case should be tried.
All right. Thank you both very much. We really appreciate the help.
Thank you. I really appreciate having you guys here.